Hello and welcome to episode 51 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month we have a stellar interview with the wonderful Aurora Ray, and you're going to hear the interview I did with her very shortly. But first we're going to see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as finding out what's going on in the world of lesfic and then in the world of me. But first up, the Amazon charts. Topping the charts in the US, as I record this on May the 15th, is the brilliantly named Raquel De Leon. Now, I don't know about if you're American, you might not know this unless you're a Coronation Street fan, but in the UK, Raquel is synonymous with the Coronation Street character played by Sarah Lancashire, who famously went out with Lofties from EastEnders. Oh, I can't remember the name of the character. That's a bit rubbish, isn't it? Anyway, famously went out with a bloke in Coronation Street. Sarah Lancashire made her name in Coronation Street, so Raquel, for me, will always be attributed to that character. Raquel, what a great name. We should bring it back. Maybe I should name a character Raquel. Raquel De Leon's book is called Wanting Her, and I have to say the cover looks like a feat of contortion to me. Do check it out. And I know it is the front of this woman's body, but it kind of looks like it could be her back as well. I mean, I can see the breasts, but honestly, her collarbone is so pronounced, they look like shoulder blades. Perhaps that's just me. Anyway, on from the cover. The book is about Vivian, who's all business, and Vivian is with a starched collar, capital B, about business. Her business partner hires someone without telling her, naughty, naughty, and obviously Vivian hates this woman. Of course she does, but April, the new hire, is determined to make this job work because she has a niece to take care of and bills to pay. And there's only one way that their antagonism is going to get worked out, of course, that is in the bedroom. Now, I haven't read this, but the reviews tell me it's a winner. And everyone is loving the ice queen being thawed. I mean, ice queens are popular for a reason, so read it and find out for yourself. Also doing well in the charts is When She Thaws by Lily Craig. Good title, Lily. I like that a lot, When She Thaws. This one has a grey-haired, no-nonsense woman on the front cover who looks very much like an ice queen to me. And so that makes it a little bit different. Grey hair, lady folding her arms, looking stern. So I quite like that. The story is about Sadie, who travels to Austria to work as an au pair for an demanding boss, Inga. I assume Inga is said grey-haired, frowny lady. Inga goes through au pairs for her three kids like nobody's business, but obviously Sadie's going to be different. Can she get into Inga's family and then into Inga's heart? Now, I don't know about you, but this one sounds like an updated version of The Sound of Music, minus the nuns and the singing. And yes, I know, they were pretty key parts of The Sound of Music, but it's set in Austria, so humour me. You know, that's the sum of the similarities. An au pair goes and melts the heart of a stern parent, so there are similarities there. And you can sing along and pretend you're a nun while you're reading it, so I'm sticking to my guns, frankly, but an interesting premise nonetheless, and a different one for a lesbian romance novel, so maybe check that out. Also riding high is Lise Gold with her book Eastern Nights, which is book 3 in the Compass series. Now, Lise has been on this podcast before and I read her book Fireflies, which was terrific. And what I like about Lise's stories is that they're based all over the world, not just in the US or the UK. And this one is set in Bangkok and involves free spirit Felicia, who meets designer Kate in a hotel bar. And they're both alpha females, but they're instantly drawn to each other. But will one back down and let the other one lead? You can watch how this plays out, or you can read how this plays out across Thailand by grabbing Lise's new book. That's called Eastern Nights. Giselle Fox is also doing well in the US with her new one, Hummingbird Cove. This is the story of Kira, who's nursing a broken heart and a bad case of writer's block. She goes to the aforementioned Hummingbird Cove for inspiration, but then Daisy arrives with aspirations to develop the whole area. Naughty, naughty Daisy. But will Kira be able to persuade Daisy to choose love over money? I think you know the answer already, but it might be fun finding out how it happens. I think you'll agree. Finally, my own book, You're My Kind, is still top 5 in the UK 2 months after release. So thank you so much, really, if you've read it or you've bought it. I really do appreciate the support. This is the story of Justine and Maddie, who meet again after 10 years apart at a friend's funeral. And it's a story of love, death and cake, all the great ingredients for a brilliant romance. I'm sure you'll agree. I might be a little biased. Okay, you know, fair warning. I did write it. But if you do read it, do get in touch and let me know what you think. mail@clareleiden.co.uk. So that's the chart roundup for May 2019. It's nearly summer, everyone. Sun's out, guns out. So quick, go and sit in the garden and get a suntan. It's brilliant sunshine in London, which I'm loving. Still not quite warm enough to maybe sit in the garden. Sort of 17 degrees, which for those of you in Fahrenheit land is about 60. But you know, it's nice to walk around in. But before I blather on about the sun anymore, let's have a look at what's happening in Lesfic land, because we're gearing up for awards season, which happens every year, and it always happens over the summer. And the awards mainly take place in the USA, but they do feature UK books and books from all around the world as well. First up, the Lambda Literary are the first gongs given out, with the ceremony taking place on June the 3rd in New York City, and I think there are still tickets left if you're in that area. So if you want to see the nominees, check out the website, which is lambdaliterary.org/awards, and Lambda is spelled L-A-M-B-D-A, and those ones are being given out in June. Also gearing up for their conference and awards is the Golden Crown Literary Society, which are the Oscars of the lesbian fiction world. The GCLS has announced finalists for all their many categories for the 2019 awards, and these are going to be given out at the annual GCLS conference, which this year is in Pittsburgh from July the 10th to July the 14th. So again, if you fancy going along to Pittsburgh, tons of writers attend this one, along with quite a lot of readers. So if you're a writer and want to meet like-minded people, go along. And if you're a reader and want to meet the people that pen your beloved lesbian fiction novels, this is also the place to be. I think there's karaoke, there's 4 days of panels and talks. So if I could go, I would, but I've got a wedding on that weekend when it's taking place. My friend's getting married in Germany, so I'm in Germany. But tons of people do attend. So if you're in the States, have a look at their website for all the finalists and details of what's going on. That's www.goldencrown.org. And I'll be reporting on the winners from both of those events when they're announced. Finally, if you're in the UK or Europe indeed and want to see me read or talk, I'm going to be at the Happy Valley Pride, which is in Hebden Bridge, which is in the north of England, not far from Leeds and Manchester, on July the 27th. I'll be reading and answering questions along with 5 other lesbian authors. So if that sounds like your bag, do come along. And if you put in Happy Valley Pride into Google, I'm sure details will come up. So what have I been up to since the last show? Well, quite a lot, actually. Firstly, I've been to Jamaica, which was lovely. I had 10 days away in the sun-filled climes for my niece's wedding. So about 40 of my family flew over from the UK for that. So it was pretty awesome. It was at a resort, so we had 10 days all-inclusive, just lying on the beach, lying by the pool, having delicious food and drinks, and a big family holiday. So that was lovely. But I do seem to have come back paler than I went. I'm not really one person for tanning. I'm one of those people who really burns. So it's really not a thing for me to go and like really try and get tanned, because it's just more pain than it's worth. So I tend to sit under an umbrella and just have a rum punch. That was my 10 days in Jamaica, which I can't complain about. As well as that, I've also been busy writing my Cotswolds romance novel, my English village romance. And this is going to be a 3-book series, but I'm only writing one of the books. Harper Bliss is writing the other one and T.B. Markinson is writing the other one. So we're going to release them all fairly quickly. So all our characters, the books all take place in the same village in the Cotswolds, and all our characters will be walking down the same street, drinking in the same pubs. They're going to be passing the same shops, but they're independent novels and they're independently written. So I'm looking forward to those. Oh, I'm about 55,000 words in on May the 15th, so I'm hoping to get the first draft nailed by the end of the month. Then it goes off to the editor at the end of June. So busy time, but very exciting. It's always a good time writing a new book, although I am at that sticky 50,000 word stage where I'm thinking, is this all a pile of garbage? But you just have to persevere and get through that. Also, if you're patiently waiting for Made in London Book 6 in the London series, It is coming, I promise. I did write this one in January and February, but it's just kind of been put on the back burner because I've, excuse me, because I've had to get on with the Cotswold book and I had to release You're My Kind. And then I went away on holiday for 2 weeks. So time just ran out, really. I was hoping to get it out in May, but now I think it will probably be out in September because the Cotswolds book will be out in July. I'll have August to get this one ready and then I'll get it out in September. So I promise that one. Blame my holiday schedule this year, which is frankly bonkers. I've had holidays booked the whole year, so, and I'm away 2 weeks in July as well, so it's not my fault, it's my holidays fault. In audiobook news as well, because you're listening to a podcast, so I assume you like audio, I'm pleased to let you know that London Actually is now out in audio, wherever audio is found. So Audible, Amazon, iTunes, Kobo, Google, and like many, many other digital outlets all around the world. So if you're on Storytel, if you're on Hoopla, you should be able to get all these. I've included a clip of it as well at the end of this podcast to whet your appetite. Have a listen and let me know what you think. It's book 5 in the London Romance series. It's a standalone novel, so if you haven't listened to the others, you can just listen to this one. No problem, it's a contained story, but there will be like other characters from other books popping up, but you don't need to know them. If you haven't listened to the rest of the series, I encourage you to go and do it. The first 4 books are available on iTunes, Audible and Amazon, and they're all a cracking read, so the reviews say. Yes, so other than that, I've just been writing away. The other major thing that's happened, of course, since the last show is that Tottenham Hotspur, my beloved football team, have reached the Champions League final. Who saw that one coming? Not me. As a lifelong Spurs fan, I am used to things going wrong. So obviously, I did hear someone on the radio the other day saying that they fully expect Spurs to win, like 2-1, 3-1. And then this guy, who is a Radio 5 Live presenter and a lifelong Spurs fan, said what every lifelong Spurs fan was thinking. No lifelong Spurs fan expects them to win. Because we're used to failure and disappointment. So if they win the Champions League final, I might have to just lie down in a dark room for months on end. But it's great to be there, I have to say. I'm very proud of my team. And what a game. What 2 games, actually. Liverpool and Tottenham. Beating Barcelona and Ajax in those 2 amazing Champions League finals that were edge of the seat stuff. So whoever wins will be great, but obviously if Tottenham won, that would be even better. So that's on June the 1st. So by the time the next show comes out, I'll either be full of joy or full of sadness. Let's hope it's joy. Finally, I just want to tell you about Lesbians Who Write, the other podcast that I've started with my fellow author and friend TB Markinson. It's available on any podcast app that you listen on, and it's a weekly podcast. So if you would like more of me piped into your ears on a more regular basis than once a month, you can get that on Lesbians Who Write. Just go to our website, www.lesbianswhowrite.com, and you can listen to all the other episodes there. I think we're up to episode 13 or 14 now, so you can binge listen to them all. And then, yeah, subscribe on your podcast app and never miss another episode. And now let's get on with the interview with the wonderful Aurora Ray. Joining me today is US author Aurora Ray, whose latest novel, Recipe for Love, is perfect for those who want a side order of food porn with their romance. Aurora's other novels include Built to Last and the Cape End series, and she describes herself as a writer, femme and hopeless romantic. Aurora lives in Ithaca, New York, with her dogs and other wildlife. So welcome, Aurora.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you here and joining us all the way from America, which is always very exciting. How is it in America today? What have you been up to so far?
Well, at the moment, it's raining.
Okay.
And it's going to rain all day. So that's a little bit sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
In the Northeast, we have had a very slow slog to spring. So
yeah,
things are finally green, but it's quite rainy. But otherwise, things are doing fairly well over here.
But
how about you?
Your disposition is sunny, is it?
I hope so. I am for
that. it's very springy in London today, so that's good. It's a bit like over with you. It's taken a little while, but not as long, because I know I've got a family in Toronto, and they were saying the same thing. So I think it's kind of similar-ish weather there, isn't it? Tell me a little bit about where you're sitting today and what you can see. Put the listener into the room you're in.
I am in my kitchen, sitting at the island. I'm fortunate to have a very large kitchen island in my house. It's actually where I do most of my writing. Mm-hmm. It's a cozy little space. The way the house is situated, there are a couple of windows, but it's not super bright. So the distractions are minimal, which is good, because when I'm writing, I need as little distraction as possible.
Yes, it's always good. And I have to say, you have got one of my life goals is to have a kitchen island. And so you've achieved it. So well done on my behalf.
It's something I aspire to for most of my life.
Right.
And so when I moved into this house and it was one of the selling features.
Right. Yeah. You high-fived yourself. So tell me a little bit about your writing journey then and how you got started.
Sure. I wrote when I was a kid. I wrote in high school. In college, I started as a biochemistry major, but about a year in, switched to English. Very much wanted to be a writer, but spent more time wanting to be a writer than actually writing. Mm-hmm. Didn't finish very many things. And then after school, I got a job and started working and only dabbled now and again until a friend of mine challenged me to do National Novel Writing Month. I'm not sure if you're familiar. It's the month of November. It's this worldwide thing where everyone writes 50,000 words in one month.
Yes. No, yes. It's NaNoWriMo, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, she did it and challenged me. And I said, well, if she can do it, I can do it. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And parts of that became Built to Last. But it was what got me in the habit of a daily writing practice, mm-hmm. and convinced me that I could actually do it. So that was 2013. And I've been sort of writing in earnest ever since.
Right, okay. And where did your first novel come out?
Winter's Harbor came out in 2015, I believe. I wrote and submitted it in 2014, and then it came out the following year.
Right, okay. So, yeah, so you've been, ever since National Novel Writing Month, your writing mojo is right there.
Yes, and now that I'm under contract with a publisher, I have deadlines.
Yeah, so. That always helps, doesn't it?
It really does. I need that external motivation, threat of legal action.
Threat of legal action, I like that. I was talking to someone yesterday about this because they were saying to me, because I'm independently published, so I am my own publisher, and they said to me, how do you motivate yourself? I said, well, I just book editors, so it's exactly the same thing. It's a deadline. So,
it's a deadline. Yeah. Absolutely.
So how would you describe one of your books to someone who's never read one before?
I tend to write kind of sweet and playful romance, low to mid-level angst, almost always some variation on a butch femme pairing, usually a foodie element of some kind. And I think I tend to skew more small town than big city.
Okay. So I guess the one I read before doing this interview, it kind of hits all those, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. It is it's a niche I find myself settling into. Stuff I know about, stuff I love. And so I find it, I wouldn't say easy to write, but definitely fun. And it's the kind of stuff I like to read as well. So that always makes it easier.
Yeah, it's your sweet spot. So your latest book, the one I was referring to, not to be cryptic about it, it's called Recipe for Love. And you describe it as a farm to table romance, which is a very niche genre. So tell me a little bit about what that means.
Sure. In America now, it's a very sort of trendy thing. To have restaurants that are farm to table, which the spirit of it is that the food is locally sourced, done, you know, in smaller scale, kind of a more personal, more local, more sustainable model. It's an interesting kind of food concept, but I really wanted to write a story that was a farmer and a chef. So that was kind of what would bring them together, was having to not just, you know, it's not just a supplier, it's actually a relationship that develops between the people who grow the food and the people who then cook it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to hint at that a little bit in the title.
And as you say, it is a story about a relationship between a farmer and a chef, and food and the growing of food is very front and center in this romance. And you go into great detail about small organic farming and how restaurants source their produce. So is this something you've got experience of, or is it something that you had to go and sort of witness for yourself and do some research?
I like to garden, and so I'm fairly familiar with the sort of how things grow, a much, much smaller scale than even a small farm, obviously, but that part came natural. There's a local farm near where I live. They do primarily like a farm stand, and people can go and pick things. And it's one of my favorite places to go in the summer and fall. The produce they grow, the apples and the peaches, and it's just a really lovely place. And I follow them on social media, so I sort of have a little bit of a sense for the feel of how that kind of operation works. So that combined with a little bit of research, and I watch a lot of food programming on television, so getting a gist of how restaurants work and things, it's something I don't have professional experience in, but it's definitely a personal interest. And so I've absorbed a lot of knowledge along the way, I'd say.
Okay. What's your favorite TV food show?
Since I'm talking to someone who's in England, I'm going to throw in a nod to one of my old school favorites, which was the Two Fat Ladies.
Oh, yeah.
Way back
yeah.
in the day.
Yeah.
I loved them dearly. In sort of what's on now, there's a program called The Barefoot Contessa, a woman who mostly cooks for her friends.
Yes.
And it's just sort of a lifestyle.
I'm a big fan of Ina Garten.
Yes, I think I want to be her, and I want to have like friends come over to play bridge, and we drink cocktails.
who doesn't want Ina's life, frankly? She just does seem to cook really fat-laden food that you know is going to taste delicious, and just drink fantastic cocktails, and she always has some gay man come over and set her table, doesn't she?
Right, and bring flowers.
Yes, every time. We actually... My wife and I went over to a friend's house for the Super Bowl. We have an American friend who lives here, and she invited us for a Super Bowl party, and she did us Ina Garten's onion dip, and that was quite sinful.
I don't think I've made it, but I have no doubt that it's rich and delicious.
It was, yeah. As you sort of just demonstrated, you're a big foodie, as am I, and that really does come across in the book. And you have a lot of recipes in the book. So are these ones that you made up, or did you steal them from somebody's menu?
Probably a mix of both. I think almost everything in the book is something that I've either like seen on a restaurant menu, had at a restaurant, or have cooked at home. A lot of times I'll have something in a restaurant and then come home and try to recreate it, which is always fun. And I'm realizing one of the big differences in home cooking is that you never use as much butter or olive oil as they do in restaurants, and that's for better or for worse, one of the big differences.
Yeah.
But it's fun to experiment.
And you set the book in the countryside around New York or New York State, which is where you live. So is it loosely based on your area then?
It is. Trumansburg is a real town, about half an hour from me. It's on the other side of one of the Finger Lakes that I live on. Uh-huh. The restaurant doesn't exist, obviously, but a few of the little places, Atlas Bowl, which is a like restaurant bowling alley, is this quirky place that really does exist in the town.
Oh, okay. So you've used actual places.
A few, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So if someone's visiting your area, and because, you know, you might drum up tourist trade now, because you can't read this book without being hungry, I have to say. If someone's visiting, where should they go and eat?
First, I'll put in a plug for Indian Creek Farm, which is my farm that people can actually visit and go pick vegetables at.
Yeah.
In terms of restaurants, my favorite in town is called Gola Osteria. It's an Italian place, but the vibe of it, the kind of energy and the way they do food is definitely inspired this book.
Okay, right, good. If I'm ever there, which I'm not sure why I would be there, but if I am ever there, I will go and look it up because it sounds delicious.
Bring me, and I'll take you there.
Okay, all right, I will do. So let's talk about the characters in your book, because they're pretty awesome as well. And one of your leads, Drew, is mixed race, which is pretty rare in lesbian land, so to be applauded. What do you think of the current state of diversity in lesbian land?
Fairly similar to mainstream, which is getting a little bit better, but we still have a long way to go. It's a tricky balance, I think, because one of the things that we need to do better in lesfic is really amplify the voices of authors of color and diverse authors and have them better represented in sort of what's published and what's out there and what's read. But I don't think acknowledging that issue means that white authors shouldn't try to create a diverse cast of characters that represent sort of real life. And so I think it's important to just not always assume that every character is going to be white. And I think you have to do it carefully, being really careful to avoid stereotypes and try to represent different ethnicities or cultural backgrounds sensitively and authentically. But I think it's something that we should all be thinking about.
Yeah, no, I'm totally in agreement there. I think I've just written a book where one of my leads is mixed race as well, because, you know, I'm living in London and I want to reflect the world around me. And it's a very multicultural, diverse place, London. So, and so is the world. So let's talk about as well the sex scenes in your book, which I have to say, I cannot, right? Because as well as food, you do write a good sex scene, I have to say. And
thank you.
You're very welcome. And you don't get a lot of sex scenes in lesbian, not the ones I read anyway, that aren't purely vanilla, but you did a brilliant strap-on sex scene in this book. I thought it was very good. So do you enjoy writing sex scenes, and what's the secret to writing a good one, would you say?
I do enjoy them. I don't, you have to, it seems, it, I always feel silly saying this, but you have to be in the mood, or at least kind of open to feeling sexy, I guess. I think one of the tricks to writing a good one is to think about things that maybe aren't necessarily vanilla. I think most of us aspire to that in our own lives and experiences, to sort of not always do the exact same thing. Like a lot of other kind of writing, sometimes it's important to think about what you want to have happen and work out the mechanics, but then go in and layer the details and the thoughts and the feelings. Because in romance, critics will say sex scenes are just kind of thrown in there gratuitously, but they're not. They're to move the story and the relationship and the romance arc forward. And so thinking about what purpose does this specific sex scene serve, it can help make it sexy, but also make it fit into the story.
Yeah, I did think that yours were very well placed and did move the story along. So that was, yeah, awesome. And your book as well, as you said earlier, is very much butch femme. But I did like how you played with the butch femme roles, because nobody is one or the other. And I think that reflects real life. And is that a theme that runs throughout all your novels?
Definitely. I personally identify as femme, although I ride a tractor around my property and like to fix things. It's sort of my identity, kind of butch and masculine of center is what I'm attracted to. And so it just feels like a really authentic way for me to write stories. I don't know if I would never write something outside of that, but definitely what I identify with, what I like to sort of read and experience. So
Right.
It is definitely my niche.
Right, yeah. Well, you do it very well. And as well as that, you're also known for your Cape End romance series, which is set in New England. And you've said, I read that you said that holds a special place in your heart. So tell us a little bit about why that is, and also a bit about the Cape End series as well.
Sure. So it's set in Provincetown, which is a very small town on the very tip of Cape Cod in Massachusetts. It's on one hand kind of a tourist mecca, but it's also really known for being an artist colony and kind of a gay tourist area. So in addition to being charming and by the ocean and filled with great shops and galleries and restaurants, it's a really, really queer place. And I think for me, one of the things that makes it most magical is that it's one of the few, if only, places I've ever been where I can walk down the street alone and be assumed queer and not assumed straight, because I'm feminine presenting. And so there's just kind of that invisibility that comes with it. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's extra special to me.
And that's why you set the series. How many books in that series?
Yeah, it's four. My very first novel was called Winter's Harbor, and I wasn't intending to write a series at the time, but after I had written a couple of other books, I really wanted to set more books in Provincetown. Mm-hmm. And so I chatted with my publisher, and we decided that since I had named that one Winter's Harbor, that it would be logical and nice to kind of do a book for each season. I did three more. Each is a standalone romance, but the characters kind of spill over into one another, and so you get to kind of see how couples are doing as the rest of the series plays out, which has been fun to write.
Right. Okay. So that series is done now, is it?
It is. Yeah. I don't know if I'll probably have to set another book in Provincetown at some point, because I love it so very much. But it's for the moment the series is done.
Do you get over there sort of from where you are a lot during the year?
I love visiting in the summer. I've done that a few times, but there's also a week in October called Women's Week, and it's a big lesfic thing in the U.S. My publisher, a couple of others, some indie authors kind of come, and there's readings and signings and panels and things like that, along with other like comedians and shows and performances. It's a really kind of fun gathering, and I've been fortunate enough to go for the last few years.
Right. Okay. I did. My wife and I went to Provincetown last year for the first time. So I know the place you're talking about. And it was, as you say, super queer. I think walking down the street, like that main street in Provincetown, felt like queer was the most represented there on the street. And that's like a very strange feeling, and a good one, but a strange one.
Right, right. It's unsettling, but also really affirming in its own way.
Yeah, no, yeah, no, I really loved it. But man, is it busy. We were there in June and it was just the guy at the place we stayed, he said, "Oh, this isn't busy." And I was like, oh my God, I'm not sure I'd want to come like at the height of summer.
It is. It's beautiful in the summer. The beach is lovely, but
yeah,
the off season can be a little bit more manageable.
Yeah, yeah. We also went to Martha's Vineyard, which I absolutely loved as well. That was great.
Still not been there. It's on my list. I'll have to make it a priority.
You must. Not quite as queer, but still really beautiful, really beautiful. So I know you have a full-time job as well as a college dean, as well as writing all these wonderful books. So is that something that your colleagues know about, your writing career?
I write under a pseudonym just to sort of keep the two separate, but everyone I work with knows that I write. A few of my colleagues have read my books, which is been kind of fun. It's a nice balance of two things. And I'm very fortunate that my boss, you know, he's the dean of a business school, is very supportive of my writing career, which I don't think is something that always happens.
Oh, that's really cool to hear. And how do you find fitting it around your job?
Some days it feels like a little bit of a challenge. I don't have children. And so I sort of feel like my friends that are raising kids, that is what they do when they're not at work. It's a very sort of consuming major lifetime commitment. So my outside of work hours are my own, aside from what my dogs demand.
Mm-hmm.
They can be fairly demanding. But I tend to write in the mornings. I write for 45 minutes or an hour or so before going to work. And then I squeeze in little pockets some evenings and over the weekend. It's been manageable so far, at least.
Oh, that's very impressive, though. So you write every day?
Almost. I try to.
Mm-hmm. That's very impressive. I'm always in awe of people, I have to say, who have full-time jobs and write as well, because I think it's very difficult to do that. But I guess if you got your process set up, then it's like it's just a habit you get into, right?
Sure. And I think sometimes I think I do well with structure. I sometimes fantasize about writing full-time, but on days that I don't have anywhere else to be, I don't write 8 hours a day. I think when you have to squeeze it in where you can, you get better at it. If I had just sort of infinite time spreading out before me, I'm not sure I would be disciplined.
No. It's very easy to lose hours on social media and the like. That's for sure. So what's your favorite thing, would you say, then, about writing, and your least favorite?
I think the running joke is the best thing about writing is having written. And having it done. I enjoy the process. I sort of love sitting down with a vague idea maybe of what needs to happen. And then, you know, the details and the conversations and the sort of actions, the things that just unfold are fun. I'm sort of surprised sometimes even what sort of ends up on the page. It's nice to be able to craft stories. And I think as a romance writer, it's nice to know that it's all going to work out. Right, that's the beauty of the romance genre, is that they're gonna live happily ever after, and that's a lovely thing.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that. I went to a meeting yesterday of the Romantic Novelists Association, which is a bit like RWA in the US. They were talking about thrillers. I was saying, I don't think I'd ever write a thriller because, you know, I don't want to kill anyone. And I don't want to harm anyone. I just want everyone to live happily ever after. So, perfect romance writer.
I think the world needs happily ever afters.
Absolutely,
right now.
Yeah, definitely right now. So, what's your least favorite thing then?
The last 20,000 words of a book. I mean, it's not usually the end. It's like stuff I'd skipped over in the middle that I didn't feel like writing, and now I actually have to go back and finish it. I sort of whine and wring my hands a lot. I think the other thing I really hate is to write a really lovely scene that ultimately doesn't fit or work or serve a purpose, and it has to get cut, even though it's nice and well written and enjoyable. It's not necessary, so it has to go, and that's always sad.
Yeah, but you know, it makes the book better in the end, so it's always good to do it as well. On the days when it's hard to get going, do you have any tricks to change your mindset?
Well, for better or for worse, I write out of order. Not on purpose. I always sort of start at the beginning. But when I get stuck, My trick is you can jump to something else, but you have to keep writing. And so I'll like have an idea for a scene, or I'll like be in the mood to write a sex scene or not write a sex scene. So I'll jump to some other part of the book. And that's really nice because it means I don't ever get completely stuck, but it means I have a lot of organizing and cleanup and, you know, consistency things that I have to do at the end to make it all flow.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that is a very good trick to do, to just jump around. I do that as well, because I think today I've got to write a sex scene, but I'm not sure I'm in the mood, so I might skip it and come back to it.
Right, and that's totally okay. Except yeah. I have a colleague who hates writing sex scenes, and so she'll have a book, and then she's like, all right, well, I have to write like 3 sex scenes now.
You see, that's...
She
yeah. Don't leave them all to the end. That's a day of pain right there. And what's the best piece of writing advice you think you've ever been given?
I think it's to write. Sit down, if not every day, as close as you can to it, and put words on the page, even if they feel terrible. A really terrible first draft is a million times better than a blank page, and it's something that you can work with and come back to. If you write and write consistently, then you're a writer. I think that's the single hardest part. You can always improve your craft, you can always clean up things and sort of get better and do better, but at the end of the day you have to get the words on the page in the first place.
No, that is something that it takes a while to realize, isn't it, that you can write a shitty first draft, but at least it's there. And what's next for you then, Aurora? What book have you got coming out?
I actually have a book set in England coming out in the fall. I visited last year for the Bold Strokes UK Book Festival, mm-hmm. And just was inspired. So I have a New York City advertising executive who inherits a pub in a small town. And so she works with a local gin distiller to kind of revamp the place. So that was really fun to write. And I'm currently writing kind of a small town second chance romance that will come out next spring. A woman who has to move back to her hometown after her marriage implodes, and a woman who never left, who's kind of had a crush on her all along, and they sort of join forces.
And the UK one, what's that one called?
It's called The Inn at Netherfield Green.
All right, okay. And have you got traditionally British dishes on the menu in that one?
A few. They are, one of the things they have to do is revamp the pub menu, which hasn't been touched in decades. You can't abandon it completely, right? There always has to be a fish and chips and some pies of different sorts.
Of course, so. Yes. Fish and chips, sausage and mash, pie, 3 stalwarts of any good pub menu in the UK. And final question, if you could be the love child of any 2 writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
That was such a fun question. I had to think of it in terms of actual sort of writing styles and storytelling, because actual love child maybe was just a little bit too weird for me. But I'm an Anglophile at heart, and so I would have to go with Jane Austen and Sarah Waters.
Very good choices, both of those. Is there any particular reasons why, apart from the obvious fantastic storytelling and word craft?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's those 2 things. I mean, I would love Austen storytelling. You know, one of the first authors I ever sort of really fell in love with when I was in high school, and I would love to sort of bring some queer energy into that part of the canon.
Super. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Aurora, and let listeners know where they can find out more about you.
Absolutely. Thank you again. This has been so much fun. I have a website, auroraray.com. I'm also on social media a fair amount, mostly Facebook. That's where I'm most interactive, so readers can find me at Aurora Ray. I'm also published with Bold Strokes Books, and the Bold Strokes website has information about appearances and upcoming releases, but you can also read the first couple chapters of all the books, so you can get a little taste for them before you decide if you want to buy it.
Yes, go and get a taste today. All right, thank you so much, and have a lovely Sunday.
Thank you so much, and same to you. Have a good one. Take care.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Club, so this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you'd like to know any more about me and my books, just head on over to my website at www.clairelydon.co.uk, or you can just look me up on any good retailer, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, iTunes, Bella Books, and anywhere books are sold. If you'd like to follow me on social media, I'm on Facebook, claire.lydon. I'm most active on Instagram, at clairefic. I'm also on Twitter, at clairelydon. Also, if you'd like a free lesbian romance novella, It Had to Be You, just sign up for my mailing list and I will send you one for free. If you'd like to do that, head on over to my website and just fill in your name and email address at the box at the top of the page. That's www.clairelydon.co.uk. This podcast is hosted and produced by The Lesbian Lounge, and thanks so much to Denise for doing just that. And join me next time when I'll actually be interviewing Denise from The Lesbian Lounge, who has released her first couple of books. So I'll be asking her, how is the process for a brand new author? Thanks so much and see you next month.
London Actually, London Romance Series, Book 5, by Claire Lydon. Read by Lucy Price Lewis. Chapter 1. If Cleo Nightingale had to list her biggest irritants, her top three would be a slam dunk. In no particular order. 1. Weddings. 2. Her brother Duncan. 3. Saturdays that involved number 1 and number 2. Saturdays like today. She rapped her knuckle on the door of his bedroom 3 times and waited for a response. Strictly speaking, it was her spare room and not his bedroom. For the moment, though, it was Duncan's, ever since Michelle had turfed him out. No answer. She knocked again. Duncan! Her tone was getting irritated. Just go without me, he shouted through the wood. Why would I want to go to a fucking wedding when I know relationships don't work anyway? The door opened and Duncan peered out, his eyes bloodshot, his face pale, his dark hair sticking up at all angles. He looked like someone who'd drunk 2 bottles of wine the previous night, and perhaps a bit of whiskey on top, mainly because he had. You know what I should do? She took a step back when she smelt his breath, a heady mix of spite and battery acid. Do enlighten me. Cleo waited for her brother's words of wisdom. This should be good. She could see his face souring as he composed the words in his head. I should turn up at the door of the church with a banner saying, don't do it, it's all a bloody con. Bang on the glass like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. They're getting married in a hotel. She tried not to smile too wide. Look, I get it, I really do. Having your wife leave you sucks. You're preaching to the choir. However, we've told Fionn we're going to this wedding. And seeing as she's one of our oldest and dearest friends, don't you think we should? Even if you don't want to go, do it for me. You're crashing in my spare room, eating my food and drinking my wine. So think of it as doing something in return. Plus, Mum and Dad are going, so they're going to expect us to be there too. He winced. Facing Mum and Dad is not top of my to-do list when my life is up shit creek. She sucked on the inside of her cheek, leaning on the hallway wall. He was acting like the baby she so vividly remembered crashing into her life when she was 5 years old, and then weeing in her Polly Pocket when he was old enough to walk. You know what I mean. I'm saying that I want to go today, and you're my plus one. I've been to enough weddings solo, and I'd prefer to have you as my escort. She raked a hand through her still knotty hair. So for me, please. Jump in the shower, iron your shirt, and be my knight in shining armour.
You're not normally fond of knights in shining armour.
I'm all for them, so long as I don't have to sleep with them. Duncan sighed, folding his arms across his chest and blowing a raspberry.
Okay, you win. I'll get showered and polish my suit of armour. I'll need it to ward off the evil spirits of marriage.
She leaned over and kissed his cheek. Thanks. She pulled back before he could breathe his angry dragon breath anywhere near her. And while you're in the shower, try to think happy thoughts. I want a smiling Duncan by my side, not a snarly one.
I'll see what I can do, he said,
standing up straight and yawning as he spoke, arms stretched over his head.
But tell me, why are you so bloody keen to go to a wedding? Marriage has hardly been kind to you either, Mrs. Divorced Before You're 40.
Cleo flinched. She knew she wasn't special, just another statistic, but when he put it like that, it sounded so much worse. For today, though, she was determined not to think about herself and just be happy for Fionn. Because who knew? Maybe it would work out for her. Maybe she would be one of the lucky ones, the ones who beamed when they spoke about their partners. It wasn't something that had happened to her, nor lately to her brother. Let's just say it's not so much the marriage, more seeing everyone again, all Fionn's family and friends. Plus, it's food I don't have to cook and wine I don't have to buy, so it gets a thumbs up from me.